Welcome to Ballistic Radio, the fastest growing gun talk show in the country. Join us. We're going to explore the topics of firearms, self-defense, and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, videos, photos, conversations that are always polite and interesting at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Matt the Minion.
Yay.
That's all I get?
Yeah.
All right.
No, how are you today, John?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, not bad.
Yeah, I just want to take a quick minute to say thank you to all the mommies out there. We certainly appreciate everything that you do. And I want to give a special thank you to my mom for putting up with my crap for the last 32 years. Mom, I appreciate it. You didn't have to do that, but
I thank her, too, for putting up with your crap.
Yeah, really, right? You wouldn't have a job otherwise.
And I thank my mom for putting up with my crap as well.
Well, you've not really done nearly as many things wrong as I have in your life. Anyway, let's not go there on air. We've got a really interesting show with Claude Werner lined up, the tactical professor. Just a quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s, ARs, and scatterguns since 1977. A legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, is there any... I don't think there's anything we really need to cover right now.
No. I mean, you've got the Wilson
Combat
Project gun back in the holster. And
yeah, there's that. Carrying one of their 9mm 1911s, have one of their shotguns that we're going to be beating on rather shortly. The LWRC project, we're still working on that. We've just got something we're waiting to announce before we can really get started. So anyway, we'll get to that another show. I don't want to waste any of Claude's time. Joining us, Claude Werner. Claude, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. How about yourself, John?
I certainly can't complain because no one would believe me if I did, so... just for those, you've been on the show two or three times now, but for those that have missed your previous appearances, just real quick, can you go over your background, then we'll get started?
Sure. Former Army officer, spent most of my time in special operations, also had been the chief instructor of the Elite Rogers Shooting School, the hardest shooting school in the world. And then when I decided to get a real job, I was the commercial real estate research director for several firms and eventually for Deloitte & Touche.
Okay, perfect. So you've got a varied background, but pretty heavy bias on actually gathering information and, you know, having concepts that you can explain as opposed to just pulling stuff out of your nether regions?
Exactly.
Okay. An important distinction that not everyone seems to make. But the reason why I wanted to have you on, you recently wrote an article about, and to give some backstory to this, there was a police officer in Skokie, Illinois, I believe, that got into a shooting with a gentleman that was intriguing because he hit the guy 14 times with a .45 caliber Glock, and guy didn't go down until the end, where I think he was hit with 3 headshots, and that's what ended the fight. But that particular police officer used it as the impetus to moving to a 9mm, carrying more ammunition on the job, which I don't necessarily disagree with his conclusion, but I disagree with why he got there, with how he got there, and you do too. Do you want to talk about that real quick, and then we'll sort of fast forward to the Garland, Texas incident that could have been similar but wasn't?
First of all, let me say I'm very happy that the officer eventually dominated the situation and was able to take his attacker out of the fight and put him down, and that the officer survived.
Of course.
You know, that's, you know, the important aspect of the thing that we need to keep in mind. What the thing that I had said in my article was is that I disagreed with the conclusion he drew as a result of his experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my closing line was that we often talk about the fog of war as if it only exists in the moment. And I feel that the fog of war also sometimes tends to skew our perceptions afterwards as well. And that's what I disagreed about the officer's conclusion, that his idea was that he was then started carrying 145 rounds of ammo on the job. He changed pistols, which, like you, I don't disagree with him on that. But then he had, you know, so many magazines on him. And that's on top of his rifle that he carried in the car and everything else.
Right.
And I thought that was the wrong conclusion out of it, because he said, as he was relating the fight in the article that I read, he said, I told myself, hey, I need to slow down and aim better.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the real important aspect of the post-incident analysis that kind of got glossed over in the article and perhaps in the officer's mind. I don't know. You never know. Anytime you read an article or something in the paper or any media publication, how much of that got mistranslated from what the original speaker said. So it's hard for us to say, but in the terms of the presentation of what he said, I didn't think that was the appropriate lesson to draw from this.
Right.
But rather that the lesson was to say, hey, we need to be able to shoot well, and we need to be able to do that on demand.
Right.
And that was the lesson to me, not I need to carry a whole lot more ammo because I might get into some kind of spray and pray mode and lose all my ammo in the process,
right,
or something like that. And then we were contrasting that with the Garland incident, which worked out very differently.
Yeah, it did. And to clarify too, I realized that I misstated the facts slightly. The gentleman that the officer shot in the first incident was actually hit 14 times with 45 caliber ammunition before the what proved to be three fatal headshots were made on the subject. I had said 14 times, three of those being the headshots. So there was a total of 17 rounds this gentleman was hit with. It does sort of bring an interesting sort of cognitive dissonance that exists to the forefront, though, is that everyone has this expectation that 45 is some sort of death ray.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I mean, for the most part, all service caliber handguns suck to about the same extent, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, there
some more so than others.
We can't count on pistols producing the same terminal effect that we can from long guns.
Right,
that's just the way it is.
Right, and the other thing too, and you pointed this out in your article that they talk about this gentleman being hit 14 times, and they say that six of them were apparently in fatal locations in the one article I read. But you sort of break it down that the numbers and the description of that don't necessarily support that. He was making a lot of periphery hits.
Actually, and John Hearn checked the incident out, and it turns out that only one of those 14 hits was actually a high center chest hit.
Okay.
There were two torso, you know, reasonably good torso hits,
mm-hmm,
but the rest of them would not even have fallen within the FBIQ bottle area.
Which is a very generous scoring zone.
That's right. It is. It's a very generous scoring area, and for most of the shots to have missed that, well, you know, you couldn't expect necessarily a 25 Mike chain gun on a Bradley to produce much effect if it's only going to skin the guy.
Right, right. And that seems to be, you know, a constantly overlooked subject. And we've got about a minute left in this segment, then we'll get to the next one. But I hear the term combat accurate thrown around quite a bit. My initial impression whenever I hear that is that someone is excusing their poor marksmanship or their poor skills or whatever and saying, well, it's good enough. What are your thoughts on that, just real quick?
Well, I think that in many cases, that definition also includes the psychological aspect of the fight.
Right.
And unfortunately, we can't train for the psychological aspect. We can only train for the physical and physiological aspects of the fight. and think about it in that context. And I think that's an important distinction that is often misunderstood about that.
Right. Well, when we get to the next segment, we can sort of just very briefly touch on why people actually stop doing what they're doing when they're shot, and explain that a little bit more for people that aren't familiar with it, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right. We're talking with Claude Werner. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by the Pauly Palooza 3 Memorial Training Conference. Join some of the top trainers in the country August 15th and 16th at the Raven Concealment Systems facility in Northern Ohio, where they will be teaching some of the most vital self-defense skills that every citizen should know. Lesson blocks will cover a myriad of topics suitable for shooters and students of all skill levels. For more information, visit paulepalooza.com. That is Paul, the letter E, Palooza, PALOOZA.com. And remember to save the date, August 15th and 16th. So we're talking with Claude Werner about two separate incidents that occurred, both with 45 caliber Glock pistols. So they sort of offer different ends of the spectrum. We're kind of comparing and contrasting, so to speak. Claude, are you still there?
Still here.
All right. So before the break, you had said that a lot of people count on the psychological aspect without really giving much thought to that. Now, what you mean when you say that, there's really only three reasons that somebody stops doing what they're doing when they're shot with a pistol, my understanding at least. And those three reasons are you've either dropped their blood pressure enough through blood loss that they pass out, you've destroyed the central nervous system, and they're no longer physically able to function, or they decide they don't want to get shot anymore, which would be a psychological stop. Is that pretty much the gist?
That's pretty much it, exactly.
Okay. And what you were saying, I guess, is that because oftentimes, I'm not saying all the time, but a lot of the time when people get shot, they stop doing what they're doing and decide they don't want to get shot anymore. People seem to expect that.
Well, I don't know if they expect it, but it's a factor in how they think about it. That making, for instance, when we were talking about the bottle shaped cue,
mm-hmm.
that even though that's a pretty generous scoring zone, and if you talk to any emergency room physician or anybody who has any familiarity with anatomy, they'll say that much of the cue, although it might even prove a fatal wound, is not going to provide a wound that's going to stop the action particularly quickly.
Well, and let me interrupt there real quick just because mm-hmm. I think that touches on something really important. We don't care if they die next Thursday from what we've done to them. We don't care if they die at all, really. We just want them to stop doing what they're doing, correct?
Exactly. Okay. That's what we're looking for. Whether they live or die is irrelevant. It's whether they stop or don't stop that is the relevant factor.
Okay. It seems like that in the training culture, at least, some places, not all places, and I'll say even less places than there were 2 or 3 years ago, It's not so much that people are telling you to expect that, but there seems to be sort of a casual attitude about, well, if you put rounds on them, that'll probably do the trick.
And, you know, actually, that is true most of the time.
Yep.
The problem is it's not true all of the time. And so I think that what we have to think about in this context is that, first of all, we have to have a contingency plan that includes, hey, maybe I need to shift my targeting zone. As one of my mentors said, if you shoot some guy 3 or 4 times in the body and he doesn't react to that, more is probably not likely to do you any good.
Mm-hmm.
You need to think about picking out a better target.
Okay. So I guess what it sort of stems back to is picking training protocols that work every single time versus ones that work most of the time?
Well, picking training protocols that have a high probability of success.
Okay.
Once again, like we're talking about with handguns, they're not the reliable stoppers that we would like them to be.
Right.
So the more that we can stack, and I like to think about things in terms of stacking the deck in my favor.
Mm-hmm.
Because any incident has an element of chance to it, and we have to accept that. But at the same time, I would much you know, to put it in a Las Vegas context, I would much rather play blackjack than keno.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So as far as that goes, and I think this is something else that you just touched on that's important. If you put three or four rounds into someone and it's not effective, you pick a better target. What would some better targets be? Or what's that?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is you need to start looking at the guy's head.
Okay.
Because even and there's been a certain amount of discussion just in the past few weeks about headshots, how difficult they are, that you have to get bullets inside of the ocular window and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I knew a bunch of Chicago police officers when I was in Chicago who had shot people in the head.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, in almost no case that I can recall, did any of their bullets ever get inside the skull.
Mm-hmm.
But in every case, the guy realized, you know what? They're going to kill me if I don't give up.
Right. Well,
and then let's take the case that people frequently cite about the shooting that occurred when Jimmy Cirillo was on the New York Stakeout Squad,
mm-hmm.
where none of the bullets went into the guy's head.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like two detectives shot him, I think, 11 times with their snubs,
mm-hmm.
and not one of them went into the guy's head.
Right.
But it knocked him cold.
Yeah. Well, and
good
that's,
enough.
Well, right. And that's why you say the ocular cavity or the ocular window. What we're talking about is if you imagine a 3x5-inch index card shape and place it pretty much directly over the eyes. That's the target we're aiming for. It sort of coincides with the ears if you're looking at someone in profile. But those are areas where the bullet is likely to penetrate. Higher head hits, oftentimes, as you just stated, don't penetrate the skull or glance off the skull at an angle or what have you.
But, you know, Mike Tyson's punch does not penetrate the skull either.
Mm-hmm.
But we all have a hard time coping with something like that.
Exactly.
You know, it tends to ring your bell.
Yes, yes. And I wasn't suggesting that's, you know, the only ones that are going to really counter those ones. But, you know, that when we start talking about it in detail, that's sort of what we're looking at. You know, in thinking of it, I only know one person that's been shot in the face that decided to do anything about it afterwards, and that's Jared Reston. I mean, personally, no. I'm sure there are more cases that I'm not aware of. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part, shooting someone in the face is a fight ender, for the most part.
Yeah. And once again, it's a probability thing. We're,
right.
You know, people, we cannot in this industry, in good faith, make these hard statements that this will happen, blah, blah, blah. We're always working on probabilities,
right.
and nobody likes to talk about it in that way, but that's just a fact of life, that we're dealing with probabilities here. So how do we stack the probabilities in our favor?
Okay. So there's all sorts of examples, and the reason why we're talking about headshots, because in both the instances that we're talking about, we're pretty, at least in the Garland one, there's not many details, but given what we know of the facts, it's almost certain that headshots are what stopped that fight as well, and we'll talk about that in a second. But like you said, we've got trainers that are saying that, well, a headshot under stress is impossible or close to it,
right.
Whereas we've got all sorts of real world examples that no it's not at all. So
that's right, it's not at all.
How do we reconcile that then?
Well, I think that we have to accept the fact that our training should at least include the idea that if the guy happens to stop or if the target presents itself and he's not responding to gunfire to the torso, then it's not time to start looking for a different targeting area. And if we don't practice that, then it's not going to happen. And that's one of the things that I see as a weakness in a lot of training modalities, that there's no concept of including the headshot as an alternate. You know, now gun sight had a pretty good program for that. But a lot of programs simply do not, you know, and at the Elite Rodder Shooting School, that's almost the totality of the program is that, hey, you need to start shooting at people's heads or be ready to shoot at a small target, because in many cases, what we may have is a partial target and we're not going to have a full cue to shoot at.
Right.
The Skokie officer got to the point where he was in a position where he didn't have a full target to shoot at. Fortunately, it was the guy's head was what he had to shoot at, so that's what he shot at.
Yeah.
Well, and then things turned out a lot better.
Well, and that's what ended up ending the fight was, you know, he put 14 other rounds and the guy fired a lot more. And once again, at the end, it was the headshots that ended it. Now, we've got to go to break. When we get back, we'll sort of talk about the Garland thing. And then maybe some training standards that we should think of. Right now we're talking with Claude Werner, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment is brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms, parts, and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bear, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. So right now we're talking with Claude Werner about training standards, including low-probability shots or low-percentage shots into our training, and some real-world applications of that or examples of that. Claude, are you still there?
Still here.
Okay. So we've got the Skokie officer that decides after, you know, and once again, it's very, like you said, it's very easy to Monday morning quarterback this right now in the comfort of our various workplaces or homes or whatever. And we're very happy that the officer survived. But the conclusions he drew from that seemed a little, like you said, off. He's decided to carry a 9mm because it does the same thing that a 45 does, but holds more rounds. And then he carries a lot more rounds too, which seems to me that he's sort of giving himself the opportunity to miss more again, or
could be. You know, I'm not sure beyond what he said and what he did in terms of changing his equipment, what his fundamental belief is in that.
Right.
But one of the things that struck me as a difference between an apparent difference, and like you said, we don't know that much about the Garland incident yet, but what they looked like to me was a difference between conscious competence and unconscious competence.
Right.
Now, the officer in Skokie was blasting away, and then he says, I told myself I need to slow down and aim better.
Right.
That, to me, said that he was consciously competent of his skills.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what to do as long as he could access that knowledge via his conscious mind.
Right.
As opposed to, let's take what sounds like happened with the Garland officer, is that the Garland officer just pulled his gun out
And finished it. And was
able to get on his sights, work his trigger without any conscious thought. So he was unconsciously competent.
Right.
And this is a problem that I observe in the training community a lot, is not really understanding the difference between training and practice. You know, when we train people, then we give them the illusion, and in some cases the delusion, that now they're competent.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what they, and in many cases they are actually. A good training program will provide people with a pretty high degree of competency at a conscious level.
Right.
However, if they don't practice that afterward, then they're not going to develop unconscious competence, which is in many cases, not in all cases, once again, but in many cases, and especially in a confrontation on the street with a police officer, where the police officer is not going to have much time to react. He can't afford to think about, I need to get a sight picture and work my trigger. He just needs to be, or she right. just needs to be able to do that. And what we're not doing, I think, in the training community is emphasizing enough about that you need to practice after training to really ingrain the skills that you learn in training.
Right. Well, it's my understanding, and I'm stealing this from several different people. You know, John Chapman's one of them, and I think Eric Lund said it as well, that and also Steve Fisher. So we've got three big names in the industry that have said, you know, all training classes do is show you how to practice the right way.
That's right. Ken Hackathorn says the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty common concept amongst the people that I at least respect inside the industry. So as far as we'll talk about the Garland incident here, and you know, I'll tell you my understanding of it. If you've got any other information, please share. But once again, these are general observations. I'm sure there will be more detail available. And I actually hate to really talk about something before all the facts are known, but it's very relevant to what we're discussing. And I feel comfortable enough in what I've seen to make some broad statements. What we've got is a 60-year-old patrol officer that's working an off-duty detail. He is sitting in a vehicle with a non-sworn, I want to say school security officer, but I could be wrong, that was working event security for the art contest or whatever. And we won't discuss that because that'd be a whole different show.
Thank you.
So they're about 2 hours into the event. They're blocking a driveway so they can check IDs. When a car pulls up, the officer and the security officer both step out of the vehicle about the same time that the people in the car step out of the vehicle. One of the first things that happens is one of the jihadis, I'll call them, fires some rounds, hits the security officer in the leg. The off-duty officer, the one working the off-duty detail, then proceeded to draw his sidearm. From the evidence photos I've seen, you can actually see a trail of ejected brass, which leads me to believe that he's advancing towards what he's shooting at. And he pretty much drives forward, kills one of the jihadis. The other one is getting out or has gotten out at that point, and the officer kills that one too. Now, a couple of observations. They were both armed with long guns. Now, I've seen the term assault rifle or AK thrown around. That's not the case at all, at least not by what I've seen. I know at least one of them was a Kel-Tec Sub 2000, so a pistol caliber carbine. The other one I've not seen any evidence photos of, so I'm not quite sure. But one of the other things you see, though, is laying on the ground is what appears to be a blood-soaked ballistics vest that they've cut off of someone. So they may or may not have been wearing body armor. You know, I'm going to say that they probably were just off of what I've seen, but it could have been a load-bearing vest. You know, it's hard to say. But either way, what we've got here is an officer that, when presented with two suspects armed with long guns that have cover or at least some form of concealment, decides to take the cover away from them and makes effective shots, probably headshots. So, I mean, do you want to... Have I missed anything there, or
no? That's as much information as I have at the time too. So let's accept what you said as a statement of the case right now.
Okay. So what are some of the things to highlight here, other than or there are a couple things.
Well, I think one of the things is that obviously violence of action on the officer's part was a good thing.
So you mean advancing towards?
Well, just the fact that he got his gun out and started shooting right off the bat. There was no hesitation on his part, as best I can tell. He knew, okay, this is shots have been fired.
Time to
start shooting back. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. The ability, obviously, that he had to make good hits right off the bat. You know, as I like to say, when you start plowing bullets into somebody's head, that's the best form of suppressive fire.
Right.
Well, that's what that officer appeared to do. So, you know, he took the initiative in that, and talk about resetting their OODA loop. Well, that's how you do that.
Right.
And so he obviously was prepared to do that at a skill level that allowed him to do it. And in a lot of cases, we're human beings are pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
We know what our capabilities are and what they are not.
Right.
And it's obvious that that officer knew what his capability was at an unconscious level and then applied that skill level to the circumstance.
Well, and that's actually something I'd sort of like to talk to you about as far as, you know, knowing one's skill level and how we figure that out. We've got to go to break here pretty soon, so it's I don't really have enough time to get into it, but just real quick, what's the most surprising thing about this, do you think, or at least from an outsider's perspective?
Well, you know, my perspective is that it's important to have standards, because if you have standards, you know where you are, you know where you want to go, and hopefully then you can draw some conclusions about how to get there.
Okay, perfect.
And
well, that'll be a good place to stop. Right now we're talking with Claude Werner. You're listening to Ballistic Radio.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Tac Strike Steel Target System, makers of the quarter-scale steel target and the arch-frame target stand, which are literally the best steel targets and target stands I've ever used. Target stands? Great. I've hit their steel targets with more than 30,000 rounds of rifle and pistol ammunition, probably closer to 45 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I shoot a lot. With not a single problem at all, or without a single problem at all. For more information, visit them at TacStrike.com. That is TacStrike.com. I almost feel bad about that advertisement. I'm sorry, Rob. I did the best I could. I'll do better next time. Anyway, we're talking with Claude Werner about two separate incidents. Claude, are you still there?
Still here.
Okay. So we were saying, you know, right before the break that knowing what you're able to do, even, you know, if that's on an unconscious level, can play a huge part in the outcome of an event just based off of what actions we take, or maybe even a confidence thing?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think that knowing what your skill level is and being able and knowing that you can apply that to a circumstance, to an extent, that alleviates fear and prevents panic.
Okay. So there are, without naming any names, there are a couple of very notable trainers that, you know, don't like using timers in their training programs and don't really have any standards that they hold anyone to, because, and the logic behind this being, well, their logic behind this being, well, we're not competing against other people, we're only living up to the best that we can do, or something like that. And I'm paraphrasing, but it seems like someone that's been through a training program like that in this circumstance possibly wouldn't have fared as well. You know,
could be hard to say
right.
In retrospect.
Right.
But that's the leaf blowers are outside. I hope you can't hear that.
No, I can. It's okay. I just figured you were in a men's bathroom drying your hands or something else more nefarious. Who knows? Joe, the producer, is just sort of closing his eyes and shaking his head. You're going to leave that in the recording, though, I hope. So good, good. So anyway, what I mean to say is, if you've never had to make a tight shot before, or, you know, put yourself on a timer and tried to go faster than you're able to go to see what that is, you really can't know these things, can you?
No, you can't. And I think that's the point of it. That's why I think that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that as we progress, obviously our standards change.
Right.
And the way I think about it with my students is, at first, and I deal mostly with on an indoor, I teach mostly on an indoor range, and with people that are not particularly experienced shooters. So my initial standard is be able to hit a B-27 target.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the be-all and end-all.
No.
Then I think that progresses. For instance, Chuck Hagger talked about the fact that in his state, in Kansas, their standard is to be able to hit the Q target, the bottle. But what he did with his agency was he went to the ILFEQ that has that high center chest hit,
right,
and they made that part of it their standard.
Right.
So then the standard just kept increasing. that we want to have an increasing level of skill. And if we don't impart that to our students, I think we're doing them a disservice.
Well, and it's funny you mention that. So I'll relate, you know, clearly I can only relate my own experience, but, you know, I oftentimes talk to a lot of people that, you know, right or wrong, think I'm a good shooter. And I always tell them, no, I'm really not that good of a shooter. And then they sort of get annoyed at me because they think I'm humble bragging or something like that, which I'm really not. The thing is that the people I'm comparing myself to are some of the best shooters in the world, which I don't measure up to at all. Whereas the people they're comparing themselves to, it's like you said, that standard should hopefully, as we progress as shooters, increase and keep increasing.
Mm-hmm.
How do we instill that in people, or do we?
Well, one of the things that I do is when I finish a class, I give people a program to follow when they leave the class. And that's something that I've gotten in a few classes, but not that many, where so people leave and they have this implicit expectation that now they're trained.
Right.
Well, if you don't say, okay, here's where your training is now, and this is like a land navigation exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you now? Where do you want to be?
How do you get
to where you want to be?
Right.
And so I give people a program to say, hey, okay, right now you can hit a B-27. The next step up is you ought to practice so that you can hit the -8 zone of, the 8-point zone of an NRA D1 target, which is still 12 inches in diameter.
Right.
You should be able to hit that. That should be your next target. And then once you can hit that consistently, now you need to start working on it in terms of how fast can I do that.
Right.
And learn where that's at. And I think that's a missing component of how we and the training community, and I include myself in that, how we need to structure things for our students so they understand, where do I go from here?
Well, and it's really difficult to pin anybody down and say, this is, you know, and I don't think this should happen, but there seems to be a lot of, well, this is good enough. No one will ever say what good enough is, because you really don't know what good enough is until you're presented with it, do you?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we should just try and be the absolute best that we're able to be?
I think so. And ultimately, you just say, well, if I keep practicing, how good can I get?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I know I'm good? Like many times I run into people and they'll say, oh yeah, I'm pretty good with a pistol. Okay, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, I hit the target every time.
Well, that's good.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty good, I guess. And actually, you know what, compared to some people, it is pretty good.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's your standard of proficiency is a moving target.
Right.
And the target is always, I hope, with the people that I teach, the standard is always moving up.
Yeah.
Which is one reason why I disagree with the idea of not demonstrating
mm-hmm.
in classes, because I want people to have some idea of the standard that they can learn to shoot to, because frankly, a lot of people don't know what pistols are capable of producing.
Right.
You know, they've seen the TV shows where people fire, you know, the heroes fire hundreds of rounds without hitting anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, pistols can produce pretty good results. I mean, I work with a Sky, and I know that people are amazed at the idea that with a small double action only pistol that I can tear the X-ring out of an NRA D1 target 7 yards. They just didn't think that was possible. But when I demonstrate that to them, okay, that's where you can go if you want to put in the time and the effort.
Well, and that's, yeah. It seems like, you know, everyone should have goals. You know, my personal goals, I'd, you know, and this is a little thing, but I want to be the second person to shoot the Rogers standards clean from concealment. You know, Gabe White's the only one that's done it so far. I'd like to be the second. Whether or not that'll happen anytime soon or while I'm living is, you know, still up for debate, but that's something that I'm shooting for. Anyway, we're running out of time, Plug. If people want to find out more about you, where can they get that info at?
They can go to my website, tacticalprofessor.com, all one word. And actually, if they go there, they'll be able to find my just-released pistol skill-building program that will tell them how to implement some of the things that we've been talking about on the show today.
Excellent. So, and you're also going to be at the Polypalooza Conference, too, aren't you?
No, actually, I will be teaching a class out of the country, so I'm not going to be able to make it to Polypalooza this year.
I'm sad. I'm so sad. Well, Claude, I appreciate you joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, John.
All right. You enjoy the rest of your day, sir. Be safe. So make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.